Today's program has been brought to you by Heritage Foods USA, the nation's largest distributor of heritage breed pigs and turkeys. For more information, visit heritagefoodsusa.com.
I'm Greg Blaze, host of Cutting the Curd. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Heritage Radio Network. We are coming to you live, as always, from the back of Roberta's Pizza here in Bushwick, Brooklyn. You're listening to The Farm Report. I'm your host, Erin Fairbanks, and today we're continuing our conversation on the sheep and lamb industry here in the U.S. Today we're going to talk a little bit about technology and how different tech advances are being adapted or not adapted here in the States and how we should be thinking about them. We're joined again on the line by John Wilkes, who's my co-producer on this series. John, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Erin. Thank you for those warm words. Yes, looking forward to the show. I'm armed with a nice big mug of tea, ready to roll.
Excellent. Well, so I guess we should start by talking a little bit about, you know, what we mean when we say technology, what kind of things are included in that, and maybe what kind of things aren't. You know, I don't want folks out there thinking we're talking about spaceships and lasers when we're really talking about something else. But what are some of the objects in the realm of the tech space as it relates to the livestock industry?
Well, in relation to the sheep industry, we have Professor Reed Redden coming on, who is on the NSIP, which is the National Sheep Industry sort of program, which is looking to research and find ways to introduce the technology. So the technology really, the main thing that they're into is estimated breed values. And using the technology of ultrasound to take measurements of the animal as it's growing, at various points in its life to ascertain the amount of meat that it's carrying. And then these figures are then put into other numbers which are gathered, weights at weaning and birth weights. And so the technology really is taking all these various pieces of information, birth weights, birth numbers, then the resultant animal, the amount of meat it's carrying, and putting it all into a figure, an estimated breed value, EBVs, which is banded around. And this then gives an indication of the that animal's sire, or the producer of that animal, if he is going to be look to improve a breed and going to have characteristics which you would find acceptable and look to improve your production. So that's around the technology side. I'm trying to keep it simple, but does that kind of make sense?
I think so. Let me kind of throw it back at you and can tell me what I'm getting right or what I'm getting wrong. So kind of going down a path of using ultrasound technology to get a sense of what essentially the baby lamb is kind of looking like and will look like when it hits the ground. Is that right?
Yeah, that's the difference. That is the ultrasound which is used in pregnancy detection. The ultrasound can also be used in relation to the maturing animal. It's in measuring the actual depth of meat on the animal's loin. So the ultrasound can be used, yes, in pregnancy detection, but also for more importantly to assess the animal at a later stage to see how much meat it's carrying.
Let me just jump in there. So you have a lamb that, or you know, sheep that's growing, and you want to essentially kind of like take a time out and look inside of it to see how it's progressing. So
exactly.
Now, is this more of a research tool, or is this something that kind of, you know, producers are going to be looking to incorporate for their kind of regular production?
Well, it's hoped that the uptake is with the actual breeders of the stock rams and the breeding sheep that will then be used then commercially to produce the lambs. So when you're selecting a sire for your lamb production flock, you're going to be looking for an animal that has been assessed, so that you know that potentially this animal, the progeny from that animal, will give you an advantage, that they may grow quicker. Birth to sort of weaning weights are assessed, and the speed an animal will lay on meat are looked at, and the reading of the fat, the meat in the animal, and the number of animals that are born. So the idea is this information is then used to score your potential sire that you're going to use in your flock. So obviously the higher the breed value, this animal is indicated that in the progeny that it produces, you will get more lambs, and they will be a better shape, and they will have more meat. So that's kind of trying to simplify it best I can.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And so I guess ultimately, if you get in there and take a peek and, you know, there's not a great loin development, would the decision then be to not, you know, breed that animal or use that animal for breeding stock? Or what do you do if it's like not what you want?
I would say how bad it was. It's an indication, obviously, that animal potentially won't produce as good a carcass. And the thing about a carcass, of course, is visually you can appraise a sheep, but it's only when it's hanging up that you can actually see what's going on internally. So that the ultrasound does, as you say, an animal that perhaps is intimating in its breed score, as a producing ram, perhaps it isn't showing particularly good, loin development, is one you might not want to look at, and that will reflect in a lower score, because it's basically a cumulative figure that each animal has, and it takes into account these various subsections to give you a value. So obviously, an animal with a lower loin score is going to be lower down the scale. So in that sense, the ultrasound's very helpful, very useful. And as you hit on earlier, it can also be used for counting the fetus during pregnancy of the ewe, and therefore the ultrasound is a valuable management tool, so that the shepherd or the flock master can then know how many animals are inside the ewe physically to then adjust feeding in the latter stages of pregnancy to greatly enhance the survival rates and the birth weights of the individual lambs being born. So it can be used for two purposes.
And in the application of the ultrasound technology, is there, you know, kind of a wandering kind of ultrasound tech who performs this analysis for producers, or would the idea be that producers would kind of get trained up to be able to do this? And kind of on that note, are we talking about producers at a certain scale here as like a ripe target for the uptake of this particular resource?
Well, it's a useful resource at any scale, whether you have 20 ewes or 200 or 2,000 ewes, it's an incredibly valuable management tool, both for feeding and also at actual lambing time. So the actual scale of producers are relevant. The cost of machines that a Scottish company are quite big here now, because actually in another life I used to do this in the UK professionally for many years. I used to ultrasound scan many thousands of sheep every year. So it's kind of my baby, if you know what I mean. And the company that I used way back then are actually in the United States now. They're based up, because the ultrasound is used an awful lot within the dairy industry, as you can imagine, for pregnancy detection. So that's their main driver. But they are the pretty well foremost maker of a sheep scanning machine. And it's very slick now. I mean, even down to the fact that you can have the machines with actual goggles, but you don't look at the screen anymore. You're looking at, you're like a fighter pilot in an aeroplane. You have goggles on with the screens superimposed on that. So the technology's come a long way since I was doing it.
And I want to talk a little bit about kind of the ick factor, the yuck factor, the like, whoa, this is like, you know, science. For consumers, I feel like there is a, like, the idea of ultrasounding your animals and that kind of like focus and level of detail, it's not, it doesn't sit with the image of, you know, the farmer who's in tune with the land and in tune with their animals and is, you know, how do we kind of make that transition for people? I mean, there's, you say the word ultrasound, it, you know, it just brings up a score of other kind of connotations. And I'm wondering, how has the kind of response been? And, how do you anticipate consumers understanding the use of this technology?
Well, first, you have to understand that ultrasound is completely safe. Across the country, hundreds of thousands of people are ultrasounded every day, physically themselves. Ultrasound's used for, you know, even for in prenatal units. It's totally safe. It's totally safe. And I think the message to get to the consumer, whether you're using it as part of the EBV score for a potential ram sire to find a better, more meaty ram, or if you're using it as a tool to help you find out how many lambs are physically inside each animal, there is no danger with it, and particularly in the ultrasound pregnancy side of things, it can save lives. I mean, it works to the benefit of the mother in you. The ultrasound will tell you the number of animals, so if a ewe is carrying three little tiny lambs, you know that, and therefore you're able to feed that ewe to a sufficient level to make certain that she has three healthy, viable little lambs, as opposed to sort of smaller lambs that would have needed more feeding in later pregnancy, if you know what I mean. So it's very much a positive thing. That I can't see any negative aspects to it at all. It is totally safe, and it's about and it's helping the product. It's helping the farmer at the EBV side of things produce a better lamb. And if producing a better product is at the expense of using some technology, if the technology is proven to be safe, totally safe, I think it's a win-win for everybody.
And can you kind of give us some insight into how this technology is being used or not used in the U.S. in comparison to other kind of major sheep and lamb producing parts of the world?
Yeah, I can. It's a shame that Reed isn't on, because Reed has just come back, I think, or fairly recently from Australia, where this EBV breed evaluation has been going on for many years. I mean, the Australian, their use of technology and their use of detail into breeding is very, very, well, it's legendary. They devote a lot to it. It's their big industry. So they're using that kind of technology there. In the UK, we have a similar situation where most pedigree flocks are part of a scheme where they have the breed values of their individual rams are available when you go to buy the ram. So and I would imagine New Zealand is probably the same. It's the US, for some reason, interestingly, the EBVs are used extensively here within the cattle industry, I believe, and probably in the pig industry as well. But for some reason, there seems to be a disconnect to get it to be to get the uptake within the sheep sector, I can't understand it, but I believe that's the case.
Well, we are going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to be joined by Brett Taylor, who can maybe give us a little insight on that particular question. So hang tight. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Heritage Radio Network. This is the Farm Report. Stay tuned.
We'll be right back. listening to the fabulous Conti family. You've got me going, baby.
I'm not leaving this ecstasy. You're someone real. No, I'm not gonna go and leave you behind.
Since 2001, Heritage Foods USA has sold pasture-raised, antibiotic-free heritage meats to restaurants and homes around the country. Our farmers raise their animals with care using traditional methods, guaranteed to produce the very best tasting meat. Our pork breeds include Berkshire, Red Wattle, Duroc, Gloucester Old Spot, Large Black, and Tamworth, and our beef comes from Piedmontese, Angus Akiyushi, Belgian Blue, Highland, Simmental, and Belted Galloway cattle. We also carry a rotation of 24 rare breeds of heritage chicken, seasonal specialties like lamb, goat, geese, and of course, heritage turkeys. Visit us online at www.heritagefoodsusa.com or give us a call at 718-389-0985 to place your order today.
Hey, what's up? This is John Norris, and you're listening to the Heritage Radio Network.
All right, we are back after a very jazzy break. Thanks for that, Liz. We are you've tuned into the Farm Report on the Heritage Radio Network, and we are continuing our conversation on the sheep and lamb industry. In the first part of the show, we were joined by John Wilkes, who's my co-producer on this series. And in the second half, we're bringing in Brett Taylor. Dr. Taylor is a research animal scientist. He works with the USDA and runs the U.S. Sheep Experiment Station. He's out in Boise, Idaho. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you.
So, you know, we are focusing a little bit this talk on, you know, technology in the sheep and lamb industry, and definitely want to get some of your thoughts on that. But before we move forward in that area, can you give us just kind of the lay of the land? What is a sheep experiment station?
Oh, that's a very good question, and one that's it's curiosity in many people's head. Well, the U.S. Sheep Experiment Station, also known as the Range Sheep Production Efficiency Research Unit, was actually the USDA's answer to begin solving many of the sheep industry's questions as far back as 1915. So next year would be our 100-year anniversary. And since then, our research has focused on sheep that are suitable and sheep that can produce in these Intermountain West environments in Idaho and Montana, Utah, Wyoming, and in the Pacific West. And in fact, proof of that is that early 20s we released the Columbia breed, latter 20s we released the Targhee breed, and in the 70s the Polypay. But mixed in with that is also doing research on these sagebrush ecosystems that these sheep are raised in. So really, to kind of sum it up, over the past 100 years, that's the focus of a lot of our research.
So for yourself, can you give us an example of what like a typical, you know, work week might include? Like, what are some of the actual kind of on-the-ground tasks that you're doing?
Yeah, great question, too. You know, there's currently some of our latest work, at least specifically dealing with sheep. A lot of our focus over the past 6 or 7 years has been in the terminal sires. Many producers ask, you know, which sire would be best to accomplish the goal for my flock, depending on what the end product use or where their market is or where they want to sell their lambs at. So a lot of our research over the past 7 or 8 years has been sampling the nation's different sire types and measuring what does each of these breeds and what's available in these breeds.
Dr. Taylor, I'm just going to jump in real quick. Cause can you, just for folks who may not know what a sire is, we just so...
Sure.
Yeah, thanks.
Yeah, that's your ram. That's the daddy of the flock.
Got it.
And so if we want to improve, you know, if we want to improve our flock to meet whatever production goal that we want, whether it be wool or whether it be a meat product, we're going to focus on our sires. We're going to focus on those rams that are available in the industry to achieve our goals and to move our flock where we want it to be. So a lot of our work has been in that in the past 7 or 8 years to evaluate breeds and evaluate within those breeds the best rams for the producer. And so that's kind of an example there, both on the meat side and the wool side. So that's some of our current work directly with sheep.
So, for example, can you give us, like, in the meat space and then in the wool space, when you're talking about kind of sire evaluation, You know, what are some of the things that you're looking for that folks are preferencing? And if you can give us a sense, because you guys have been, you know, working over the past century, how kind of trendy is what people are looking for? How much does that, you know, change, or do things come in and out of fashion, or is it we've kind of been looking for the same characteristics, we're just kind of getting better and better and better in the same directions? Does that make sense?
Oh, it does. And, you know, really, it's a combination of the both. I think that, you know, the same old every year after every year, we know that for any type of agricultural product and things like that, that kind of process and that approach, you know, it does kind of fade out. And we have to stay with those trends, with those preferences of those consumers, while also trying to balance what we can actually produce. You know, the environments across the United States for sheep production are so diverse. And, you know, we really need to be realistic in what products that we want to go after in our sheep based upon the environment that we're producing in. So if we look at something like the sire, we know that what the American consumer wants in terms of what type of lamb do they want to consume, what do they want to see on that dinner plate. There's a variety of different markets there, from the ethnic markets that may want a cut of meat or something that's smaller in size, whereas we can look at the large restaurant, high-end restaurant industries that want to see a much larger cut of lamb for some particular dish that they're serving. So this is where, when we look at these sires and the different breeds throughout the United States, we can see what ram can that producer purchase, like I said, to go back and target whatever market that producer has identified that they want to sell their lambs in. And so that kind of brings it back to something. Same thing with the wool. We see that, you know, still, wool, people want wool. People want to wear wool. We see a lot of blended products, some wool with some synthetics. But, you know, one thing that's been established since the beginning of time, people don't want that itchy wool. So we're still, you know, we're still trying to pursue that really high-quality wool, the fine wool, the things that we want to wear close to our skin. And then again, you know, we're going to go out and see what breed and what rams within that breed do we want to bring that quality into our flock.
So I might have you to thank for a soft wool sweater some point in the future?
No, not me. You need to just always thank the American producer. The American producer, I mean, we can provide guidance and explore where a producer may not have the money or time to investigate. That's what a sheep research institution is to explore where producers just don't have the time or resources. But we always got to thank the American producers. They've always been there, opening the doors and really stretching the potential of the U.S. American sheep.
And how do producers find out about your work? I mean, how do they kind of know to go to you? How do you report to them or share the findings that you have? And how dynamic is that, like, as things are moving along and you're taking on different projects?
Yeah, really, we work from the base up. We try, when we can, we always want to cooperate with the state's land-grant institution through their Cooperative Extension Research Service. I mean, that is the real individual that can deliver those products straight to those producers. So we want to utilize that as much as possible. As far as my specific work or a lot of the scientists in the agencies I work with, they're right there with the stakeholders in like a sheep association meeting for that particular state or neighboring states. Then we work it up from there to the national level. And that's where we can kind of update producers on our current work and some of our current deliverables. But there are people, you know, people these days, each year more and more, are just relying more and more on gathering their information on the web and the internet. And you can go to the Agricultural Research Service, that's the agency that I work for, on the web, and the information staff at the Agricultural Research Service has made all of our publications available to where a person can go up and click on that particular publication and pull it down and read it. And then also just one-on-one, you know, producers mm-hmm. will call me and we'll just, you know, we'll shoot the bull or shoot the ram, I guess, for sheep production and talk about the things that we do.
Well, so one of the things John and I were talking about in the first half of the show was ultrasound technology and how that's being used. And one of the things that, you know, I was kind of wondering about is how the U.S. sheep and lamb, you know, producers compare with their uptake of different technologies, you know, ultrasound being one of them. how we compare with producers in different parts of the country. And one of the points that he mentioned was that even within the U.S., when you look across different types of livestock, the pork industry or the beef industry, for some reason, the sheep and lamb industry seems to be a little bit behind the curve with regards to technology adaptation. I mean, would you agree with that? Has that been kind of, does that ring true to kind of what you're seeing?
Somewhat, but, you know, a little background on that. It's certainly not from the lack of desire or the lack of understanding of the technology. I think that the majority of sheep producers that I visit with, and most of my interaction is in the West, but still all over. I think it's the coordination of those efforts. We know that those technologies are expensive, and even expensive from the standpoint of a cooperative. So if you have a cooperative sheep grower group, even sometimes it's a little bit expensive to invest there. But also on the other side, as far as if there are service companies that can provide that service, again, I think it's a critical mass. Are there enough sheep, you know, in the United States to really fund any person developing a business in ultrasound technologies to service just sheep? So sometimes I think there's a lack of critical mass for them to make themselves available. So you can go throughout the United States.
Could I jump in just a second?
Yeah, John, okay. I was just about to ask if you had...
Brett.
Yeah.
Hi, Brett. How are you?
Fine.
Good. Just quickly on the ultrasound pregnancy detection side of things, I know that there is, it's a bit of a gray area, and that basically in some states it can only be performed by veterinarians, even though it's just a purely non-invasive process. In the UK and in Australia and New Zealand, the ultrasound pregnancy detection can be undertaken by any competent contractor. You haven't got to be licensed, I don't think. Because if you're any good, you come back next year. If you're accurate, you do. And if you do, you come back. You don't come back. I was just wondering about in the U.S., as you explained, with the being a sort of a spread-out industry, is there much incentive for, say, independent contractors to be able to work to do the ultrasound work?
Well, I think it's dependent on what, where they want to apply the ultrasound. You know, if it's certainly looking at growth characteristics for the particular animal, mowing eye and things like that, it's certainly probably a different deal. And I'm not sure from state to state because, you know, like John, like you said, in the United States, you know, from state board, you know, from border to border, the rules can change real quick over to pregnancy diagnosis. But I do know in the Intermountain West, you will see small regions where, and I don't know as far as for each state, the certification or things that they must and must not have, but there have been groups and small businesses that can cater to that. But was in John, you brought me right to it, but that was kind of the point I was wanting to make. So you will see throughout the United States, and like very importantly pointed out, you know, regulations have a lot to do with it and certifications, but you'll see maybe a small business that can service. And my point in all that was is where those businesses are available and where they're legal, legally applied and used, you know, sheep producers they're very eager to utilize that, but it's just we just don't see that availability, you know, in all 50 states so that all producers can have the opportunity to benefit off that.
Right. So it's more of a question of kind of the infrastructure and those resources rising up to meet, you know, where the producers are. Because I'm assuming, like, often those aren't the same groups of people who are, you know, producing and building the infrastructure with regards to the tech intervention. And, like, is that stuff mostly coming not from producers, but from people who are in the industry but not producing? Does that make sense, John? Am I kind of getting that right there?
Yeah, I would say I would say so. It's about it's about people within the industry deciding they want to do stuff, as Brett implied. But the costs for small groups of producers can be prohibitive, which is a shame. But obviously, a fact, given that the industry is so spread out, it's, you know, a big country and not many sheep.
So, Dr. Taylor, kind of thinking about other focuses for your area of work, I'm curious if you can talk at all about, disease prevention, parasite issues, if there's other things that are kind of common across the industry that our particular focus at the experiment station?
Oh, yeah. You know, and here's the deal. I'm not going to be able to provide you anything in terms of parasites. I tell you what, when I moved up here to the Intermountain West, and especially in these large production systems that are on the sagebrush steppe, you know, vast landscapes, is that, believe it or not, and I know this is hard for some people to believe, but parasites, internal parasites, are not a problem. So, you know, that's kind of one of our inabilities to research here is parasite, internal parasite problems. Just, you got to have the problem. So that is a nice thing. Each region in the United States has something nice about the production system, and that's one of the things here. But disease, yes, very, very important. Our partner, and it's almost, each day goes by, I refer to it more as a sister lab, and that's same agency, Agriculture Research Service, but that's the Animal Disease Research Unit run by Don Knowles in Pullman, Washington. We work hand in hand with exploring that, how to look at flocks that we in the United States and even worldwide, we understand what we need to do to reduce the incidences of disease in our flocks. You know, proper vaccination, proper cleanliness in our production field facilities and things like that. But I think we're at the next step to where we do see that some of our sheep in the flocks, they seem to never get sick, yet there's others that do get sick, just like, you know, I mean, we see in humans and all other types of animals. And so our cooperation is at the Animal Disease Research Unit, Stephen White, Michelle Musel, Dave Schneider, those guys and gals, they focus on genetically. Do we see animals based on looking at the genetic component of that animal, I mean the molecular biology part of it, molecular genetics, can we see some marker that seems to be associated with these animals that never get sick? And if we can identify that, can we then turn around and capitalize that on our breeding program and to explore flocks that are just overall more resistant to certain types of diseases that used to plague us in the past? So that is some of our current efforts with that particular group. I think it's exciting. I think it's appropriate. And I think that's where we need to move. But we also need to be cautious when we look at disease resistance. Remember, in genetic selection, when we start chasing one trait, we can also lose traits that are very important to us in the background, traits that have to do with growth and efficiency and quality of wool and things like that. So that's what I think makes the nice marriage between the units and what we look for is we can pursue this, disease resistance or disease tolerance, but at the same time make sure we're not losing those traits and qualities that make American sheep, you know, so wonderful and so awesome.
Right, kind of taking a more holistic point of view.
Exactly. And matching it to that environment. We just can't forget, you know, we can't forget that environment. And, you know, one, as far as technology that's out there, and Michelle Musel had published this work, this is in the Journal of Animal Science, is we always want to encourage our producers and our producer co-ops to consider technologies such as needleless vaccinations, such as the pneumatic technologies that are out there. There's many companies out there, well, not many, there's several companies out there, both Canada and the United States, that have needleless vaccination technology for sheep. And what was established, what we did the research here is are we getting the vaccination effect that we want with needleless vaccination dealing with wool? You know, cattle, it's easy, you know, slick hides, slick hair. But when you're having to deal with wool, are we getting that result the same thing as using a needle? Because we know if we can get away from needles, we can eliminate a lot of lateral transfer of diseases, especially for people that still refuse to change needles. And also we can get away from the damage that needles can occur in terms of meat quality or carcass or whatever it may be. And so we see this as a real. This is something that we have been using steadily. We encourage producers to explore needleless vaccination in terms of the pneumatic-type technologies for their flocks. We think that's very important, reducing the disease and also protecting carcasses and pelts and whatnot. So anyway, those are kind of some of the current, you know, things that we're doing in terms of disease.
Right, right. And, well, what about also kind of with regards to kind of, you know, nutrient mixes or different kind of, you know, deficiencies or like how things kind of shift, you know, from region to region where there's dietary concerns?
Very good. Yeah, selenium has always been a huge interest for us here. When we look at the upper Midwest or the East Coast and the West Coast, selenium deficiency is and in parts of the Intermountain West, selenium deficiency, whether it's extreme deficiency or marginal deficiency, very prominent in all those flocks. If you don't have, even for us humans, as well as the animals that we raise. If we're deficient on selenium, we tend to die earlier, we tend to be sick more often. In our livestock, we see reproductive failure. Just their animals are just failing to reproduce. So it's a very, very important nutrient. There are good solutions for managing selenium deficiency. Sodium selenide is your most common selenium salt that you find in supplements for us, supplements for animals. But what we've found in some of these very extensive production systems, a lot of times our ability to provide supplements on a weekly basis or a daily basis are somewhat prohibitive. I mean, some of our sheep flocks, it takes 3 hours by horseback to access them, so you certainly can't haul a mineral mix back in there.
Right.
So our goal was just to look for, is there any source of selenium that we can provide them that will last a long time? And indeed, we did find a natural source. It's in high selenium feeds that we see grown in the Dakotas. And we can take co-products like a wheat grain. We can take a co-product wheat grain like wheat middlings, and we can feed that. It's rich in selenium, but only from the grains in the Dakotas and in those certain regions. But we can feed that, and we found that when we feed that, we can boost the selenium status of that animal, but it'll last for 6 months. We don't have to provide it, you know, every day. And that's just a 21-day feeding period. And we've been working with the Intermountain Farmers Association, who's a cooperator with us out of Salt Lake City, who we're in the process right now of developing. Hopefully, soon we'll have a marketable product for sheep producers. But that's been very important for us in a very long-fought research process that we've been committed to.
Wow. Well, unfortunately, we are just about out of time. I think, you know, for me, the most interesting, I think, takeaway from what we're hearing from you is that, like, with regard to technology, there's just a lot to think about, you know, different regions of the country, the kind of how it will impact, how the ease of kind of use for producers, the cost. And it's really neat, John, to have your perspective on here as well to give us a little bit of a flavor of, you know, what's happening or what's working in different parts of the world as well. So I want to thank you both so much for joining us. It's been a really interesting conversation.
Oh, thank you so much.
It's a pleasure.
It was a pleasure.
Excellent. So definitely stay tuned. We will be continuing our sheep talk next Thursday. We're going to be taking a look at sheep in the global market, so kind of continuing this conversation. Once again, I want to thank my guest, Dr. Taylor, and my co-producer on this series, John Wilkes. Been really great having you both on. This episode of The Farm Report, like all 39 of our live weekly shows, is available for free. You can find us on iTunes, Stitcher Smart Radio, but I hope you'll visit our website, www.heritageradionetwork.org. We are a member-supported organization, so if you believe in our work, I hope you'll consider clicking that Donate tab and becoming a member today. Thank you so much for listening, and stay tuned in.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.